The House on Maple Street. Although she was only 5 and the youngest of the Bradbury children, Melissa had very sharp eyes, and it wasn't really surprising that she was the first to discover something strange had happened to the house on Maple Street while the Bradbury family was summering in England. She ran and found her older brother Brian and told him something was wrong upstairs on the 3rd floor. She said she would show him, but not until he swore not to tell anyone what she had found. Brian swore, knowing it was their stepfather Lissa was afraid of. Daddy Lou didn't like it when any of the Bradbury children got up to foolishness. That was how he always put it. And he had decided that Melissa was the prime offender in that area. Lissa, who was stupid no more than she was blind, was aware of Lou's prejudices and had become wary of them. In fact, all of the Bradbury children had become rather wary of their mother's second husband. It would probably turn out to be nothing anyway, but Brian was delighted to be back home and willing enough to humor his baby sister. Brian was 2 full years her senior, for at least a while. He followed her down the 3rd-floor hallway without so much as a murmur of argument, and he only pulled her braids, he called these braid pulls emergency stops, once. They had to tiptoe past Lou's study, which was the only finished-off room up here, because Lou was inside, unpacking his notebooks and papers and muttering in an ill-tempered way. Brian's thoughts had actually turned to what might be on TV tonight. He was looking forward to a pig-out on good old American cable after 3 months of BBC and ITV, when they reached the end of the hall. What he saw beyond the tip of his little sister's pointing finger drove all thoughts of television from Brian Bradbury's mind. "Now swear again," Lissa whispered. "Never tell anyone, Daddy Lou or anyone, or hope to die." "Hope to die," Brian agreed, still staring. And it was a half hour before he told his big sister Laurie, who was unpacking in her room. Laurie was possessive of her room, as only an 11-year-old girl can be, and she gave Brian the very dickens for coming in without knocking, even though she was completely dressed. "Sorry," Brian said, "but I gotta show you something. It's very weird." "Where?" She went on putting clothes in her drawers, as if she didn't care, as if there was nothing any dopey little 7-year-old could tell her, which would be of the slightest interest to her. But when it came to eyes, Brian's weren't exactly dull. He could tell when Laurie was interested, and she was interested now. "Upstairs, 3rd floor, end of the hall past Daddy Lou's study." Laurie's nose wrinkled as it always did when Brian or Lissa called him that. She and Trent remembered their real father, and they didn't like his replacement at all. They made it their business to call him just plain Lou. That Lewis Evans clearly did not like this, found it vaguely impertinent, in fact, simply added to Laurie and Trent's unspoken but powerful conviction that it was the right way to address the man their mother, slept with these days. "I don't want to go up there," Laurie said. "He's been in a pissy mood ever since we got back. Trent says he'll stay that way until school starts, and he can settle back into his rut again. His door's shut. We can be quiet. Listen, me went up, and he didn't even know we were there." "Listen, and I." "Yeah, us. Anyway, it's safe. The door's shut, and he's talking to himself like he does when he's really into something." "I hate it when he does that," Laurie said darkly. "Our real father never talked to himself, and he didn't used to lock himself in a room by himself either." "Well, I don't think he's locked in," Brian said, "but if you're really worried about him coming out, take an empty suitcase. We'll pretend like we're putting it in the closet where we keep them if he comes out." "What is this amazing thing?" Laurie demanded, putting her fists on her hips. "I'll show you," Brian said earnestly, "but you have to swear on Mom's name and hope to die if you tell anyone." He paused, thinking for a moment, and then added, "You especially can't tell Lissa, because I swore to her." Laurie's ears were finally all the way up. It was probably a big nothing, but she was tired of putting clothes away. It was really amazing how much junk a person could accumulate in just 3 months. "Okay, I swear." They took along 2 empty suitcases, one for each of them, but their precautions proved unnecessary. Their stepfather never came out of his study. It was probably just as well. He had worked up a grand head of steam from the sound. The 2 children could hear him stamping about, muttering, opening drawers, slamming them shut again. A familiar odor seeped out from under the door. To Laurie, it smelled like smoldering athletic socks. Lou was smoking his pipe. She stuck her tongue out, crossed her eyes, and twiddled her fingers in her ears as they tiptoed by. But a moment later, when she looked at the place Lissa had pointed out to Brian, and which Brian now pointed out to her, she forgot Lou just as completely as Brian had forgotten about all the wonderful things he could watch on TV that night. "What is it?" she whispered to Brian. "My gosh, what does it mean?" "I dunno," Brian said. "But just remember, you swore on Mom's name, Laurie." "Yeah, but..." Say it again. Brian didn't like the look in her eyes. It was a telling look, and he felt she really needed a little reinforcement. Yeah, yeah, on Mom's name, she said perfunctorily. But Brian, Jeezly Crow. And hope to die, don't forget that part. Oh, Brian, you are such a cheeser. Never mind, just say you hope to die. Hope to die, hope to die, okay? Laurie said. Why do you have to be such a cheeser, Bri? Dunno, he said, smirking in a way she absolutely hated. Just lucky, I guess. She could have strangled him, but a promise was a promise, especially one given on the name of your one and only mother. So Laurie held on for over one full hour before getting Trent and showing him. She made him swear, too. And her confidence that Trent would keep his promise not to tell was perfectly justified. He was almost 14, and as the oldest, he had no one to tell, except a grown-up. Since their mother had taken to her bed with a migraine, that left only Lou, and that was the same as no one at all. The two oldest Bradbury children hadn't needed to bring up empty suitcases as camouflage this time. Their stepfather was downstairs, watching some British fellow lecture on the Normans and Saxons. The Normans and Saxons were Lou's specialty at the college, on the VCR, and enjoying his favorite afternoon snack, a glass of milk and a ketchup sandwich. Trent stood at the end of the hall, looking at what the other children had looked at before him. He stood there for a long time. "What is it, Trent?" Laurie finally asked. It never crossed her mind that Trent wouldn't know. Trent knew everything. So she watched, almost incredulously, as he slowly shook his head. "I don't know," he said, peering into the crack. "Some kind of metal, I think. Wish I'd brought a flashlight." He reached into the crack and tapped. Laurie felt a vague sense of disquiet at this, and was relieved when Trent pulled his finger back. "Yeah, it's metal." "Should it be in there?" Laurie asked. "I mean, was it? Before?" "No," Trent said. "I remember when they replastered. That was just after Mom married him. There wasn't anything in there then but laths." "What are they?" "Narrow boards," he said. "They go between the plaster and the outside wall of the house." Trent reached into the crack in the wall and once again touched the metal, which showed dull white in there. The crack was about 4 inches long and half an inch across at its widest point. "They put in insulation, too," he said, frowning thoughtfully, and then shoving his hands into the back pockets of his wash-faded jeans. "I remember. Pink, billowy stuff that looked like cotton candy." "Where is it, then? I don't see any pink stuff." "Me either," Trent said, "but they did put it in. I remember." His eyes traced the 4-inch length of the crack. "That metal in the wall is something new. I wonder how much of it there is and how far it goes. Is it just up here on the third floor, or..." "Or what?" Laurie looked at him with big round eyes. She had begun to be a little frightened. "Or is it all over the house?" Trent finished thoughtfully. After school the next afternoon, Trent called a meeting of all four Bradbury children. It got off to a somewhat bumpy start, with Lissa accusing Brian of breaking what she called your solemn swear, and Brian, who was deeply embarrassed, accusing Laurie of putting their mother's soul in dire jeopardy by telling Trent. Although he wasn't very clear on exactly what a soul was, the Bradburys were Unitarians, he seemed quite sure that Laurie had condemned mothers to hell. "Well," Laurie said, "you'll have to take some of the blame, Brian. I mean, you were the one who brought Mother into it. You should have had me swear on Lou's name. He could go to hell." Lissa, who was young enough and kind-hearted enough not to wish anyone in hell, was so distressed by this line of discourse that she began to cry. "Hush, all of you," Trent said, and hugged Lissa until she had regained most of her composure. "What's done is done, and I happen to think it all worked out for the best." "You do?" Brian asked. If Trent said a thing was good, Brian would have died defending it. That went without saying. But Laurie had sworn on Mom's name. "Something this weird needs to be investigated, and if we waste a lot of time arguing over who was right or wrong to break their promise, we'll never get it done." Trent glanced pointedly up at the clock on the wall of his room, where they had gathered. It was 3:20. He really didn't have to say any more. Their mother had been up this morning to get Lou his breakfast. 2 3-minute eggs with whole wheat toast and marmalade was one of his many daily requirements. But afterward she had gone back to bed, and there she had remained. She suffered from dreadful headaches, migraines that sometimes spent 2 or even 3 days snarling and clawing at her defenseless and often bewildered brain before decamping for a month or so. She would not be apt to see them on the third floor and wonder what they were up to, but Daddy Lou was a different kettle of fish altogether. With his study just down the hall from the strange crack, They could count on avoiding his notice and his curiosity only if they conducted their investigations while he was away, and that was what Trent's pointed glance at the clock had meant. The family had returned to the States a full 10 days before Lou was scheduled to begin teaching classes again, but he could no more stay away from the university once he was back within 10 miles of it than a fish could live out of water. He had left shortly after noon, with a briefcase crammed full of papers he had collected at various spots of historical interest in England. He said he was going up to file these papers away. Trent thought that meant he'd cram them into one of his desk drawers, then lock his office and go down to the history department's faculty lounge. There he would drink coffee and gossip with his buddies. Except, Trent had discovered, when you were a college teacher, people thought you were dumb if you had buddies. You were supposed to say they were your colleagues. So he was away, and that was good, but he might be back at any time between now and 5, and that was bad. Still, they had some time, and Trent was determined they weren't going to spend it squabbling about who swore what to who. "Listen to me, you guys," he said, and was gratified to see that they actually were listening, their differences and recriminations forgotten in the excitement of an investigation. They had also been caught by Trent's inability to explain what Lissa had found. All three of them shared, at least to some extent, Brian's simple faith in Trent. If Trent was puzzled by something, if Trent thought that something was strange and just possibly amazing, they all thought so. Laurie spoke for all of them when she said, "Just tell us what to do, Trent. We'll do it." "Okay," Trent said. "We'll need some things." He took a deep breath and began explaining what they were. Once they were convened around the crack at the end of the third floor hallway, Trent held Lissa up so she could shine the beam of a small flashlight. It was the one their mother used to inspect their ears, eyes, and noses when they weren't feeling well, into the crack. They could all see the metal. It wasn't shiny enough to throw back a clear reflection of the beam, but it shone silkily just the same. Steel, was Trent's opinion. Steel or some sort of alloy. "What's an alloy, Trent?" Brian asked. Trent shook his head. He didn't know exactly. He turned to Laurie and asked her to give him the drill. Brian and Lissa exchanged an uneasy glance as Laurie passed it over. It had come from the basement workshop, and the basement was the one remaining place in the house which was their real father's. Daddy Lou hadn't been down there a dozen times since he married Catherine Bradbury. The smaller children knew that as well as Trent and Laurie. They weren't afraid Daddy Lou would notice someone had been using the drill. It was the holes in the wall outside his study they were worried about. Neither one of them said this out loud, but Trent read it in their troubled faces. "Look," Trent said, holding the drill out so they could get a good look. "This is what they call a needlepoint drill bit. See how tiny it is? And since we're only going to drill behind the pictures, I don't think we have to worry." There were about a dozen framed prints along the third floor hallway, half of them beyond the study door, on the way to the closet at the end where the suitcases were stored. Most of these were very old and mostly uninteresting views of Titusville, where the Bradburys lived. "He doesn't even look at them, let alone behind them," Laurie agreed. Brian touched the tip of the drill with one finger, then nodded. Lissa watched, then copied both the touch and the nod. If Laurie said something was okay, it probably was. If Trent said so, it almost certainly was. If they both said so, there could be no question. Laurie took down the picture which hung closest to the small crack in the plaster and gave it to Brian. Trent drilled. They stood watching him in a tight little circle of three, like infielders encouraging their pitcher at a particularly tense moment of the game. The drill bit went easily into the wall, and the hole it made was every bit as tiny as promised. The darker square of wallpaper which had been revealed when Laurie took the print off its hook was also encouraging. It suggested that no one had bothered taking the dark line engraving of the Titusville Public Library off its hook for a very long time. After a dozen turns of the drill's handle, Trent stopped and reversed, pulling the bit free. "Why'd you quit?" Brian asked. "Hit something hard." "More metal?" Lissa asked. "I think so. Sure wasn't wood. Let's see." He shone the light in and cocked his head this way and that before shaking it decisively. "My head's too big. Let's boost Lissa." Laurie and Trent lifted her up, and Brian handed her the penlight. Lissa squinted for a time, then said, "Just like in the crack I found." "Okay," Trent said. "Next picture." The drill hit metal behind the second and the third as well. Behind the fourth, by this time they were quite close to the door of Lou's study. It went all the way in before Trent pulled it out. This time when she was boosted up, Lissa told them she saw the pink stuff. "Yeah, the insulation I told you about," Trent said to Laurie. "Let's try the other side of the hall." They had to drill behind four pictures on the east side of the corridor before they struck first wood lath and then insulation behind the plaster. And as they were rehanging the last picture, they heard the out-of-tune snarl of Lou's elderly Porsche turning into the driveway. Brian, who had been in charge of hanging this picture, he could just reach the hook on tiptoe, dropped it. Laurie reached out and grabbed it by the frame on the way down. A moment later, she found herself shaking so badly she had to hand the picture to Trent, or she would have dropped it herself. "You hang it," she said, turning a stricken face to her older brother. "I would have dropped it if I'd been thinking about what I was doing. I really would." Trent hung the picture, which showed horse-drawn carriages clopping through City Park, and saw it was hanging slightly askew. He reached out to adjust it, then pulled back just before his fingers touched the frame. His sisters and his brother thought he was something like a god. Trent himself was smart enough to know he was only a kid. But even a kid, assuming he was a kid with half a brain, knew that when things like this started to go bad, you ought to leave them alone. If he messed with it any more, this picture would fall for sure, spraying the floor with broken glass, and somehow Trent knew it. "Go," he whispered. "Downstairs, TV room." The back door slammed downstairs as Lou came in. "But it's not straight," Lissa protested. "Trent, it's not—" "Never mind," Laurie said. "Do what Trent says." Trent and Laurie looked at each other, wide-eyed. If Lou went into the kitchen to fix himself a bite to tide himself over until supper, all still might be well. If he didn't, he would meet Lissa and Brian on the stairs. One look at them and he'd know something was going on. The two younger Bradbury children were old enough to close their mouths, but not their faces. Brian and Lissa went fast. Trent and Laurie came behind, more slowly, listening. There was a moment of almost unbearable suspense when the only sounds were the little kids' footsteps on the stairs, and then Lou bawled up at them from the kitchen. "Keep it down, can't you? Your mother's taking a nap." And if that doesn't wake her up, Laurie thought, nothing will. Late that night, as Trent was drowsing off to sleep, Laurie opened the door of his room, came in, and sat down beside him on the bed. "You don't like him, but that's not all," she said. "Who? What?" Trent asked, peeling a cautious eyelid. "Lou," she said quietly, "you know who I mean, Trent." "Yeah," he said, giving up, "and you're right, I don't like him." "You're scared of him, too, aren't you?" After a long, long moment, Trent said, "Yeah, a little." "Just a little?" "Maybe a little more than a little," Trent said. He winked at her, hoping for a smile, but Laurie only looked at him, and Trent gave up. She wasn't going to be diverted, at least not tonight. "Why? Do you think he might hurt us?" Lou shouted at them a lot, but he had never put his hands on them. No, Laurie suddenly remembered, that wasn't quite true. One time when Brian had walked into his study without knocking, Lou had given him a spanking, a hard one. Brian had tried not to cry, but in the end he had. And Mom had cried, too, although she hadn't tried to stop the spanking. But she must have said something to him later on, because Laurie had heard Lou shouting at her. Still, it had been a spanking, not child abuse, and Brian could be an insufferable cheese dog when he put his mind to it. Had he been putting his mind to it that night, Laurie wondered now? Or had Lou spanked her brother and made him cry over something which had only been an honest little kid's mistake? She didn't know, and had a sudden and unwelcome insight, the sort of thought that made her think Peter Pan had had the right idea about never wanting to grow up. She wasn't sure she wanted to know. One thing she did know, who the real cheese dog around here was. She realized Trent hadn't answered her question, and gave him a poke. "Cat got your tongue?" "Just thinking," he said. "It's a toughie, you know." "Yes," she said soberly. "I know." This time she let him think. "Nah," he said at last, and laced his hands together behind his head. "I don't think so, Sprat." She hated to be called that, but tonight she decided to let it go. She couldn't remember Trent ever speaking to her this carefully and seriously. "I don't think he would, but I think he could." He got up on one elbow and looked at her even more seriously. "But I think he's hurting Mom, and I think it gets a little worse for her every day." "She's sorry, isn't she?" Laurie asked. Suddenly she felt like crying. Why were adults so stupid sometimes about stuff kids could see right away? It made you want to kick them. She never wanted to go to England in the first place, and there's the way he shouts at her sometimes. "Don't forget the headaches," Trent said flatly. "The ones he says she talks herself into. Yeah, she's sorry, all right." "Would she ever, you know, divorce him?" "Yes," Laurie said, relieved. She wasn't sure she could have brought the word out herself, and had she realized how much she was her mother's daughter in that regard, she could have answered her own question. "No," Trent said, "not Mom." "Then there's nothing we can do," Laurie sighed. Trent said in a voice so soft she almost couldn't hear it.
Oh, yeah?
During the next week and a half, they drilled other small holes around the house when there was no one around to see them, holes behind posters in their various rooms, behind the refrigerator in the pantry. Brian was able to squeeze in and just had room to use the drill. In the downstairs closets, Trent even drilled one in a dining room wall, high up in one corner where the shadows never quite left. He stood on top of the stepladder while Laurie held it steady. There was no metal anywhere, just lath. The children forgot for a little while. One day, about a month later, after Lou had gone back to teaching full-time, Brian came to Trent and told him there was another crack in the plaster on the third floor and that he could see more metal behind it. Trent and Lissa came at once. Laurie was still in school, at band practice. As on the occasion of the first crack, their mother was lying down with a headache. Lou's temper had improved once he was back at school, as Trent and Laurie had been sure it would, but he had a crackerjack argument with their mother the night before about a party he wanted to have for fellow faculty members in the history department. If there was anything the former Mrs. Bradbury hated and feared, it was playing hostess at faculty parties. Lou had insisted on this one, however, and she had finally given in. Now she was lying in the shadowy bedroom with a damp towel over her eyes and a bottle of Furanol on the night table, while Lou was presumably passing around invitations in the faculty lounge and clapping his colleagues on the back. The new crack was on the west side of the hallway, between the study door and the stairwell. "You sure you saw metal in there?" Trent asked. "We checked this side, Bri." "Look for yourself," Brian said, and Trent did. There was no need of a flashlight. This crack was wider, and there was no question about the metal at the bottom of it. After a long look, Trent told them he had to go to the hardware store right away. "Why?" Lissa asked. "I want to get some plaster. I don't want him to see that crack." He hesitated, then added, "And I especially don't want him to see the metal inside it." Lissa frowned at him. "Why not, Trent?" But Trent didn't exactly know. At least, not yet. They started drilling again, and this time they found metal behind all the walls on the third floor, including Lou's study. Trent snuck in there one afternoon with the drill, while Lou was at the college and their mother was out shopping for the upcoming faculty party. The former Mrs. Bradbury looked very pale and drawn these days, even Lissa had noticed. But when any of the children asked her if she was okay, she always flashed a troubling, overbright smile and told them never better, in the pink, rolling in clover. Laurie, who could be blunt, told her she looked too thin. "Oh, no," her mother responded. "Lou says I was turning into a blob over in England, all those rich teas. She was just trying to get back into fighting trim, that was all." Laurie knew better, but not even Laurie was blunt enough to call her mother a liar to her face. If all four of them had come to her at once, ganged up on her, so to speak, they might have gotten a different story, but not even Trent thought of doing that. One of Lou's advanced degrees was hanging on the wall over his desk in a frame. While the other children clustered outside the door, nearly vomiting with terror, Trent removed the framed degree from its hook, laid it on the desk, and drilled a pinhole in the center of the square where it had been. 2 inches in, the drill hit metal. Trent carefully rehung the degree, making very sure it wasn't crooked, and came back out. Lissa burst into tears of relief, and Brian quickly joined her. He looked disgusted, but seemed unable to help himself. Laurie had to struggle very hard against her own tears. They drilled holes at intervals along the stairs to the second floor, and found metal behind these walls, too. It continued roughly halfway down the second floor hallway as it proceeded toward the front of the house. There was metal behind the walls of Brian's room, but behind only one wall of Laurie's. "It hasn't finished growing in here," Laurie said darkly. Trent looked at her, surprised. "Huh?" Before she could reply, Brian had a brainstorm. "Try the floor, Trent," he said. "See if it's in there, too." Trent thought it over, shrugged, and drilled into the floor of Laurie's room. The drill went in all the way with no resistance. But when he peeled back the rug at the foot of his own bed and tried there, he soon encountered solid steel, or solid whatever it was. Then, at Lissa's insistence, he stood on a stool and drilled up into the ceiling, eyes slitted against the plaster dust that sifted down into his face. "Boink," he said after a few moments. "More metal. Let's quit for the day." Laurie was the only one who saw how deeply troubled Trent looked. That night, after lights out, it was Trent who came to Laurie's room, and Laurie didn't even pretend to be sleepy. The truth was, neither of them had been sleeping very well for the last couple of weeks. "What did you mean?" Trent whispered, sitting down beside her. "About what?" Laurie asked, getting up on one elbow. "You said it hadn't finished growing in your room. What did you mean?" "Come on, Trent, you're not dumb." "No, I'm not," he agreed without conceit. "Maybe I just want to hear you say it, Sprat." "If you call me that, you never will." "Okay. Laurie. You satisfied?" "Yes, that stuff's growing all over the house." She paused. "No, that's not right. It's growing under the house." "That's not right either." Laurie thought about it, then sighed. "Okay," she said. "It's growing in the house. It's stealing the house. Is that good enough, Mr. Smarty?" "Stealing the house." Trent sat quietly beside her on the bed, looking at her poster of Chrissy Hynde, and seeming to taste the phrase she had used. At last he nodded and flashed the smile she loved. "Yes, that's good enough." "Whatever you call it, it acts like it's alive." Trent nodded. He had already thought of this. He had no idea how metal could be alive, but he was damned if he saw any way around her conclusion, at least for the present. "But that isn't the worst." "What is?" "It's sneaking." Her eyes, fixed solemnly on his, were big and frightened. "That's the part I really don't like. I don't know what started it or what it means, and I don't really care, but it's sneaking." She ran her fingers into her heavy blonde hair and pushed it back from her temples. It was a fretful, unconscious gesture that reminded Trent achingly of his dad, whose hair had been that exact same shade. "I feel like something's going to happen, Trent, only I don't know what, and it's like being in a nightmare you can't get all the way out of. Does it feel like that to you sometimes?" "A little, yeah. But I know something's going to happen. I might even know what." She bolted to a sitting position and grabbed his hands. "You know? What? What is it?" "I can't be sure," Trent said, getting up. "I think I know, but I'm not ready to say what I think yet. I have to do some more looking." "If we drill many more holes, the house is apt to fall down." "I didn't say drilling. I said looking." "Looking for what?" "For something that isn't here yet, that hasn't grown yet. But when it does, I don't think it will be able to hide." "Tell me, Trent." "Not yet," he said, and planted a small, quick kiss on her cheek. "Besides, curiosity killed the sprat." "I hate you," she cried in a low voice, and flopped back down with the sheet over her head. But she felt better for having talked with Trent, and slept better than she had for a week. Trent found what he was looking for 2 days before the big party. As the oldest, he perhaps should have noticed that his mother had begun to look alarmingly unhealthy, her skin drawn shiny over her cheekbones, her complexion so pale it had taken on an ugly yellow underlight. He should have noticed how often she was rubbing at her temples, although she denied, almost in a panic, that she had a migraine, or had had one, for over a week. He did not notice these things, however. He was too busy looking. In the 4 or 5 days between his after-bedtime talk with Laurie and the day he found what he was looking for, he went through every closet in the big old house at least 3 times, through the crawl space above Lou's study 5 or 6 times, through the big old cellar 6 times. It was in the cellar that he finally found it. This was not to say he hadn't found peculiar things in other places. He most certainly had. There was a knob of stainless steel poking out of the ceiling of a second-floor closet. A curved metal armature of some kind had burst through the side of the luggage closet on the 3rd floor. It was a dim, polished gray, until he touched it. When he did that, it flushed a dusky rose color, and he heard a faint but powerful humming sound deep in the wall. He snatched his hand back as if the armature had been hot, and at first, when it turned a color he associated with the burners on the electric stove, he could have sworn it was. When he did that, the curved metal thing went gray again. The humming stopped at once. The day before, in the attic, he had observed a cobweb of thin, interlaced cables growing in a low, dark corner under the eave. Trent had been crawling around on his hands and knees, not doing anything but getting hot and dirty, when he had suddenly spied this amazing phenomenon. He froze in place, staring through a tangle of hair as the cables spun themselves out of nothing at all, or so it looked, anyway, met, wrapped around each other so tightly they seemed to merge, and then continued spreading until they reached the floor, where they drilled in and anchored themselves in dreamy little puffs of sawdust. They seemed to be creating some sort of limber bracework, and it looked as if it would be very strong, able to hold the house together through a lot of buffeting and hard knocks. What buffeting, though? What hard knocks? Again, Trent thought he knew. It was hard to believe, but he thought he knew. There was a little closet at the north end of the cellar, far beyond the workshop area and the furnace. Their real father had called this the wine cellar, and although he put up only about 2 dozen bottles of plonk, this word had always made their mother giggle, they were all carefully stored in crisscrossing racks he had made himself. Lou came in here even less frequently than he went into the workshop. He didn't drink wine, and although their mother had often taken a glass or two with their dad, she no longer drank wine either. Trent remembered how sad her face had looked the one time Bri had asked her why she never had a glass of plonk in front of the fire anymore. "Lou doesn't approve of drinking," she had told Brian. "He says it's a crutch." There was a padlock on the wine cellar door, but it was only there to make sure the door didn't swing open and let in the heat from the furnace. The key hung right next to it, but Trent didn't need it. He left the padlock undone after his first investigation, and no one had come along to press it shut since then. So far as he knew, no one came to this end of the cellar at all anymore. He was not much surprised by the sour whiff of spilled wine that greeted him as he approached the door. It was just another proof of what he and Laurie already knew. The changes were winding themselves quietly all through the house. He opened the door, and although what he saw frightened him, it didn't really surprise him. Metal constructions had burst through 2 of the wine cellar's walls, tearing apart the racks with their diamond-shaped compartments and pushing the bottles of Bollinger and Mondavi and Bottiglia onto the floor where they had broken. Like the cables in the attic crawlspace, whatever was forming here, growing, to use Laurie's word, hadn't finished yet. It spun itself into being in sheens of light that hurt Trent's eyes and made him feel a little sick to his stomach. No cables here, however, and no curved struts. What was growing in his real father's forgotten wine cellar looked like cabinets and consoles and instrument panels. And as he looked, vague shapes humped themselves up in the metal like the heads of excited snakes, gained focus, became dials and levers and readouts. There were a few blinking lights. Some of these actually began to blink as he looked at them. A low sighing sound accompanied this act of creation. Trent took one cautious step farther into the little room. An especially bright red light, or series of them, had caught his eye. He sneezed as he stepped forward. The machines and consoles pushing across the old concrete had stirred up a great deal of dust. The lights which had snagged his attention were numbers. They were under a glass strip on a metal construct which was spinning its way out of a console. This new thing looked like some sort of chair, although no one sitting in it would have been very comfortable. At least no one with a human shape, Trent thought with a little shiver. The glass strip was in one of the arms of this twisted chair, if it was a chair, and the numbers had perhaps caught his eye because they were moving. 72, 34, 18. Became 72, 34, 17. And then 72, 34, 16. Trent looked at his watch, which had a sweep second hand, and used it to confirm what his eyes had already told him. The chair might or might not really be a chair. But the numbers under the glass strip were a digital clock. It was running backward, counting down to be perfectly accurate. And what would happen when that readout finally went from 00001 to 00000 some 3 days from this very afternoon? He was pretty sure he knew. Every American boy knows one of 2 things happen when a backward-running clock finally reads zeros across the board. An explosion, or a liftoff. Trent thought there was too much equipment, too many gadgets, for it to be an explosion. He thought something had gotten into the house while they were in England. Some sort of spore, perhaps, that had drifted through space for 1 billion years before being caught in the gravitational pull of the Earth, spiraling down through the atmosphere like a bit of milkweed fluff caught in a mild breeze, and finally falling into the chimney of a house in Titusville, Indiana. Into the Bradbury's house in Titusville, Indiana. It might have been something else entirely, of course, but the spore idea felt right to Trent, and although he was the oldest of the Bradbury kids, he was still young enough to sleep well after eating a pepperoni pizza at 9 p.m., and to believe completely in his own perceptions and intuitions. And in the end, it didn't really matter, did it? What mattered was what had happened, and, of course, what was going to happen. When Trent left the wine cellar this time, he not only snapped the padlock's arm closed, he took the key as well.